What I want to do, if possible, is just to provoke you a little bit. Kick the hornet's nest, I think, is the American expression, where they have hornets. Just to try and get you thinking and asking some questions. And I want to talk for 25 minutes or so, maybe 20 minutes, about some of the things you've got in front of you. And then the floor is yours, and we'll just knock some ideas around and see where that takes us. My overall... if you want to know, what do I think about the relationship between science and the Christian faith? I would say that science is a spectacularly successful way of understanding quite a lot of the world. And yet, there are many things that science can't explain, because in fact, it was never developed as a way of understanding everything. And therefore, to be a scientifically minded person from a Christian perspective, to believe in the God of the Bible, and to take on board the insights of science, actually makes you a better scientist. Because it means there's more about the world that you're able to understand than if you didn't believe in God, and you tried to do science that way. And to try to flesh out that, I want to just highlight six areas of scientific endeavour or philosophy which highlight the conflict, if you like. And I want to try and show you that I think in each case, at the very least, a Christian, someone who believes in the Bible, who follows Jesus Christ, who believes that there is a God in control of all of this, somebody who believes those things, as I do, is in a better position to understand things than somebody who does not. Okay, make sense? Happy? Nobody fainted yet? No equations on this, you see? Couple of numbers, but no equations. All right, let's just start. Just in the most general way, at the top of this page, you see we've got this big spidery diagram? You've got one like this, without all the extra scribbles on. Just look at the top, where it's labelled number one. It says, limitations of science. This, in one sense, I've got two quotes here. The one on the just top left, a chap called Sir Peter Medawar, who's a Nobel Prize-winning biologist. And he highlights in a number of different places the fact that there are obviously some limitations to what science can tell us. Let me just read that quotation for you. The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike, elementary questions. How did everything begin? What are we all here for? What's the point of living? What he's highlighting is that there are some questions that science can't answer. That's no discredit to science. He's a scientist, and he doesn't think that science suffers just by admitting that. Actually, it's a wise thing to do, to acknowledge the limitations of what we think. But not all scientists take the same approach. My old professor of... Peter Atkins, professor of chemistry at the University of Oxford. I once sat in some extremely dull thermodynamics lectures from Peter Atkins. Not his fault, really, because thermodynamics is kind of dull, really. It's like all the boring bits of physics and chemistry stuck into one box, and poor old Professor Atkins got the box. But he thinks slightly differently. He says, quote, "There is no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence." I just think that's not true. And what's interesting to me is there's an increasing number of scientists who believe it's not true, and philosophers who think it's not true. Even people who aren't Christians. Some stuff I've been thinking about recently, which isn't on here, is to do with the mind and consciousness. And there are an increasing number of religious philosophers and scientists who recognise we just don't have the first clue what the mind is. We don't know, we don't really understand what consciousness is and how it relates to our physical brain. We have no idea. And it seems to me the smart money is on admitting that. Not pretending that you can understand things you can't. But I better flesh that out a little bit, because as we walk around the diagram, we're going to go around clockwise to number two. We come across the big chestnut that everyone thinks I'm going to spend my whole time talking about whenever I mention science and Christianity, and that is creation and evolution. On the one hand, you've got someone like Richard Dawkins, right at the top right-hand corner of the page, who says, "The theory of evolution is about as much open to doubt as the theory that the Earth goes round the Sun." Well, okay. On the other hand, the Bible opens with words that seem to challenge that pretty directly. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So you've got this imagined conflict. Yeah, it looks like religion was doing fine and Christianity was doing fine until about 150 years ago. Then it ran into the rock of Darwin, and that's when it's kind of collapsed and imploded and gone nowhere ever since. However, I want to highlight two glaring shortcomings in the theory of evolution. And this is not just me now talking, these are increasingly widely acknowledged by secular, non-religious evolutionary biologists. The first is where the first living thing came from. Just think about this for a second. Evolution purports to explain how something that's already alive can pass on its genetic material to the next generation, and how successive generations can change. So you can start with an amoeba and end up with something more complicated. What it can't explain is where the first one came from. Stuart Kaufman, evolutionary biologist, says this: anyone who tells you that he or she knows how life started on Earth some 3.4 billion years ago is a fool or a knave. Nobody knows. And that shouldn't be taken as a criticism of evolutionary theory. I'm about to criticise it in a second, but that isn't. All that's doing is saying this is beyond the remit of this theory to try and explain where the first living thing came from. But there's a more deep-seated problem, I think, with theory of evolution. Let's suppose you could get started. Let's suppose that we ignore the question of where the first organism came from that could reproduce itself. Basically, what you need for evolution to work is things that can make copies of themselves badly. So you have, let me caricature, okay? You've got a giraffe which can make bad copies of itself. So it copies the neck length badly, some with short necks, some with long necks. Turns out the ones with long necks do better at reaching high leaves on high trees, and therefore the ones with long necks are better equipped to pass on their genes to the next generation and so on. So you need something that can make bad copies of itself. Suppose we start with that. Well, what does it take in order to go from something very, very simple to something much more complicated, like a person or a goldfish or a squirrel or something like that? What's needed is an increase in genetic information. Okay, this is normally the point where one or two eyes start to glaze over. Okay, so just take a drink. I'm about to. Many people have a kind of vague outline idea of what evolution is about, but if you get a bit technical, it starts to be a bit frightening. But don't worry, let me just try and explain it. Basically, every cell in your body contains a code, the DNA code. DNA is the name for the molecule that has the code written on it. And it's a bit like a computer program. The computer program tells your body how to build itself. Now, you need a much more complicated computer program to build you than you do to build like a little single-celled organism, like an amoeba or something like that. What that means, then, is to go from something simple to something complicated, you need to generate a complex string, a complex long list of data. And in the middle of the 20th century, people started to apply formal mathematical analysis to this process. And they started to ask the question, well, is it possible to go from a simple string of information to a more complicated and longer string of information just randomly? It turns out that it isn't possible to do that. Now, there's lots of kind of complexity at that point, but the key issue is that if that mathematical analysis actually applies to a living organism and the code which determines what we look like and our characteristics, it amounts to a mathematical proof that evolutionary theory can't work. Unless, and this is the big unless you have an external source of information. You know, you can't get information from nowhere. That's what the mathematical theory says. So either evolution can't work, or there's some external mind inputting information into the process. Now, for myself, I'm happy with the idea of an external mind inputting information into the process. I would be, wouldn't I? I believe in God. But it makes it quite difficult to understand how you could be an atheist evolutionist, you suddenly have this mathematical problem to deal with. To my knowledge, nobody has really dealt with this yet very well. Not surprisingly, because it's quite a new insight in the last 20 years or so. Perhaps there's a reason, actually, why nobody's dealt with this. If you work in a university, and perhaps some of you know this either from student days or maybe even working in the universities now, you will know universities claim to be the place where everything can be discussed and everything is open and everyone can have whatever opinions they like as long as they're willing to discuss them openly. It's not true. It is very, very difficult, if not impossible, to be an evolutionary biologist today in a mainstream university and question the theory of evolution. It just can't be done. You lose your job, or you wouldn't get your job in the first place. There's a wonderful story about this that highlights the issue, especially in Western universities. A Chinese paleontologist and biologist called Jun Yuan Chen, actually I've got a quotation from here just on the page in front of you. He was working in China, and he had done some work on fossils in China, which led him to question one or two aspects of the accepted evolutionary line of some organisms. He wasn't panning the whole theory of evolution, right? He was just questioning one or two details. Not sure about that. And he was invited to a conference in America to present his findings. This is back in 1999. And he presented his paper, and he got a really cold reception. Like, people were really kind of... You know, if you've ever done a paper at a scientific conference, you know what it feels like when people don't like it. Anyway, so I sympathise with him at that point. And he asked his host afterwards, he said, what did I do? What did I say? Could people not understand me? Did I say something offensive? You know how it is if you call a Canadian, American, you know, maybe I did that, or the equivalent by accident. And his host said, well, listen, Mr. Chen, Professor Chen, you need to understand American biologists don't like to hear such challenges to the theory of evolution. And he said something very funny, which I thought was, I've written it down here. He said, it's funny, you know, in China we can criticise Darwin, but not the government. In America, you can criticise the government, but not Darwin. And that's kind of funny and tragically true. And of course, what it means is that sometimes the scientific establishment will be very slow to catch up with its own limitations. It's no surprise, therefore, that many of the challenges to evolutionary theory, especially regarding the mind and consciousness, which I mentioned earlier, are coming from philosophers. And you've got biologists and people who work in the sciences, like Daniel Dennett, who are busily shouting, we can explain it all, we can explain it all, while with philosophers, Thomas Nagel and others like him, saying, really? What clue? Nobody knows what consciousness even is. Never mind how it could have evolved. So, creation and evolution seems to me it's not quite the sewn-up case that it's made out to be. Happy so far? Okay, right. Let's move on and change the subject completely to another whole area, which is more philosophical, really. Ethics and morality. Ask yourself a basic question. Where does morality come from? Or, let's make it more pointed. If you were an atheist, if you didn't believe in God, how could you explain human ethical feelings, the sense of right and wrong that we have, morality in general? I like to explain this with a little story called the burglar problem, or the problem of the philosophical burglar. You go home to your flat or your house in Finchley tonight and you find yourself there, a burglar, in your front room, busily unscrewing your flat screen TV from the wall, you know, swag bag in hand, okay? And you say, okay, put the TV down, please, leave my house. Please, you know, he's bigger than you, and you don't want to upset him, but, you know, he's nicking your TV, for goodness sake. You don't want to get out of my house. Get out of my house! You know? Anyway, and he says, well, what are you talking about, get out of your house? Well, look, it's my TV. He says, well, I don't think it's your TV at all. Well, what do you mean? Well, for me, morally speaking, I kind of found it here, and because I found it here, I have every right to take it off you. So, well, that's not the moral universe anybody else lives in. It's my TV. I bought it. Now, here's the thing. What you've entered into is a moral debate. He's going to claim the TV is his. He's a philosophical burglar. This isn't going to happen. Okay, but he's a philosophical burglar. He'll claim that he has the right to take the TV, but you're a moral, philosophically minded person yourself, and you're going to say, it's not your TV, I've got the receipt, it's mine here. Now, imagine for a moment there's no God. Who are you going to appeal to decide the debate? Who are you going to appeal to? And is there any higher authority you can go to?
The police.
The police? You can go to the police, but what if you're in a country where there either are no police, Somalia, or where the police are corrupt and agree with the burglar?
Let's get your mates round.
Now that's exactly the point. What happens in such situations where people start denying that there's some moral authority over everybody? What happens is that moral discussions turn into fights. Morality disappears off the agenda and we end up with an exercise of power. Now that's what you have in completely lawless societies, where public morality breaks down completely, like in Somalia, Mogadishu. Right? The people who survive there are the people who are willing to kill everybody who gets in their way. That has been the case in many parts of the world, where either people have thought they could get away with anything, well dressed, or where people have abandoned the idea of moral absolutes. What really tends to happen is that the weakest people in society get victimised. Who are the weakest people in our society? The elderly and the unborn. And as our society has abandoned Christian moral values, the elderly and the unborn are being abandoned and killed in vast numbers. And the reason is because people don't think anybody's watching. They don't think anybody who's going to do anything about it is watching. When people lived in fear of Almighty God, they were slower to kill their babies when they didn't want them. Now, at the same time, now I'm hearing Richard Dawkins shouting, whispering in my ear, he would want to say, rightly, that many, many wicked things have been done in the past in the name of religion. For example, the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, Al-Qaeda, and so on. Moreover, the Bible itself appears to condone, and I think does condone, some one-off events that we find a little hard to understand. Joshua chapter 10 verse 40, they totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord the God of Israel had commanded. And perhaps that will raise some questions. Now, I don't think that poses terminal problems for either the Bible's authority and truthfulness or for belief in God, but I do recognise that all religious people, well, as a Christian, I just want to put my hands up and say, yeah, Spanish Inquisition, actually nothing to do with me, but it was wicked and reprehensible. Take that one on the chin. Yeah. Many, many wicked things have been done in the name of serving our God. And where appropriate, those responsible should be held accountable for doing so, and everybody else who's connected ought to apologise. That doesn't mean that God therefore doesn't exist. Where actually this takes you, if you are an atheist, if you can't find a basis for moral absolutes, a overarching moral ethical framework anywhere in your world, you tend sometimes to follow the conclusions of your argument, and you end up where Richard Dawkins ends up at the bottom right hand corner of the page, where he says, this is an alarming thing to say really. He says, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, check this, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, at that point, I want to criticise him, not for being unethical, but for being a bad scientist. Because it seems to me that's a really bad description of the universe we observe. The universe we observe doesn't have those properties. If atheism were true, it would have those properties. But atheism is not true. And that's why it doesn't have those properties. The universe is not filled with blind, pitiless indifference. It's filled with organisms like you and me that care. And we care because there is a God who cares, who made us. So that whole area of thought, ethics and morality, it seems to me makes a lot more sense from a Christian point of view. Let's scoot off up to the top left-hand corner of the page and think about something, again, completely different.